President Trump left a G7 summit in Canada a day ahead of schedule.
The president said it was to focus on the rapidly escalating conflict between Israel and Iran. He also posted a warning on his social media platform, Truth Social, telling Iranians to immediately evacuate their capital.
For more, we're joined by NPR's Adil Alshalchi in Tel Aviv. So considering President Trump's warning, what's the mood like in Tehran right now?
Well, we know that people are very anxious. There is an atmosphere of panic and confusion in Tehran today. People are stocking up on food. Tehran's streets are quiet, especially at night, which is when Israel carries out most of its strikes. NPR reached out to a woman named Baran in Tehran. She asked us to only use her first name because the situation is so sensitive in Iran right now. She said she and her family tried to leave Tehran yesterday, but had to turn around. You can feel the fear, hear the fear in her voice. She says they couldn't fill up their tank. All gas stations had lines a couple miles long and people were waiting up to 4 hours for fuel. The roads out of the city are also bumper-to-bumper traffic, so leaving, evacuating Tehran is no easy feat right now.
Now, Israel's ambassador to the UN told us last week that preemptive strikes were meant to prevent Iran from putting together a nuclear weapon. So 5 days in, how has Israel's messaging and actual targets changed?
I mean, you're right. So almost immediately after the start of the attack on Friday morning, Israel struck military targets, killing top security officials like the chief of staff of Iran's army. It also struck three nuclear facilities, including the main one called Natanz. But now Israel is expanding its attacks. For example, yesterday, the Israeli military attacked the studio complex of Iran's state news channel. You know, there's a video online of the moment this happened. You hear the anchor speak and then the explosion. You know, in the video, you see the anchor flee the studio and pieces of the roof start to fall on top of her head. Israel's defense minister confirmed the attack, saying, quote, "We will strike the Iranian dictator everywhere." So now the question is the political apparatus fair game now? Will Israel go for Iran's supreme leader next, for example?
Yeah, so if Israel does that, I mean, does this mean this war changes from nuclear capabilities to regime change?
So the Israeli military has said that it's been instructed to dismantle Iran's nuclear capabilities, not specifically for regime change. But in an interview on ABC yesterday, correspondent Jonathan Carl asks Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu this question.
So are you going to target the supreme leader?
Look, we're doing what we need to do. I'm not going to get into the details.
So, you know, Netanyahu hasn't ruled it out.
All right. So where does this put the United States now?
So far, the U.S. has only helped with defending Israel with the interception of missiles. Trump has, always said that Iran, he doesn't want Iran to have a nuclear weapon. He says he has, but a preference is to do this via a deal. He said that maybe Israel's war may force Iran to make a deal. But now, you know, Iran pulled out of the talks. So now, as the war intensifies, all eyes may be on whether or not Trump changes course and decides to directly get involved in the war.
NPR's Adil Alshalchi in Tel Aviv. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
The man suspected of killing a Minnesota state lawmaker and her spouse and wounding another lawmaker and his wife now faces federal and state murder charges.
Police apprehended 57-year-old Vance Belter late Sunday in rural Minnesota.
NPR's Meg Anderson is here. So, Meg, Minnesota's acting U.S. Attorney General has called what happened in Minnesota a political assassination. What is suspect Vance Belter charged with?
Yeah, Belter is facing 6 federal charges, including 2 counts of murder for the killings of Minnesota State Representative Melissa Hortman and her husband. Those charges can carry the death penalty if he's convicted. He's also facing federal charges for shooting State Senator John Hoffman and his wife. At the state level, officials charged Belter with 2 counts of second-degree murder and 2 counts of attempted second-degree murder, but officials say they do plan to pursue first-degree murder charges.
Okay. Now, federal authorities released more details yesterday. What did they have to say?
That's right. And the details officials describe about what happened are really chilling. Belter allegedly went to the Hoffman residence first, where video of the exchange was recorded on a security camera. That video shows a man wearing a hyper-realistic silicone mask and dressed like a police officer. He knocks and yells that he's the police and to open the door. Here's acting U.S. Attorney Joseph Thompson at a press conference yesterday describing what happened next.
Senator Hoffman and his wife, Yvette, came to the door. When they opened the door, Belter shined the flashlight in their faces and said there had been a shooting reported in the house. Belter asked if they had any weapons. When Belter lowered his flashlight, which he had shined in their face, they realized that he was not a police officer.
The man, officials allege is Belter, began shooting right after that, and Hoffman's daughter, Hope, is the one who called 911. After that shooting, Belter allegedly went to the homes of two other state lawmakers, but was not able to get to them. Then he allegedly went to Hortman's home, where officials say he killed her and her husband.
Now, officials there are saying that all of this was a targeted political attack. Why are they saying that?
Yeah, so there was a notebook found inside the alleged shooter's car, which we've learned more about now. It contained a hit list with the names of at least 45 lawmakers and officials in Minnesota and several other states and at the federal level. It is now confirmed that they were mostly or all Democrats. Here's the FBI special agent in charge of the Minneapolis field office, Alvin Winston.
This was a targeted attack against individuals who answered the call to public service. Let me say this clearly. Political violence has no place in this country.
Police also recovered six guns from the scene. Most of those were found in the abandoned car. And they say that, you know, if the alleged suspect had not been forced to flee, they think he would have kept going on his rampage.
What's going to happen next?
Yeah. So Belter is now in federal custody. On June 27th, he's going to have a preliminary hearing. That's the time that a judge will decide whether or not to set bail.
All right. That's NPR's Meg Anderson. Meg, thanks.
You're welcome.
One of the darkest, most complicated chapters of the U.S. opioid crisis may finally be nearing an end.
Purdue Pharma and members of the Sackler family, who own the company, have reached a $7.4 billion opioid settlement with all 50 states and U.S. territories. If it's approved, the plan would end a legal fight over the harm caused by OxyContin, the company's opioid painkiller.
NPR's addiction correspondent Brian Mann is here now. So, Brian, we're going to dive into the legal and financial part of this settlement in just a second. First, though, remind us how Purdue Pharma and OxyContin changed America.
Well, it's really huge. Opioid pain medications used to be doled out very cautiously by doctors and hospitals. And what we've learned in legal documents made public during this court fight is that under the leadership of members of the Sackler family, Purdue Pharma convinced regulators in the healthcare industry OxyContin could be used a lot more liberally, they said, without a huge risk of addiction or overdose. And that turned out not to be true. Ryan Hampton is an addiction activist now. He was hooked on OxyContin for a decade.
It completely destroyed my life. It took almost everything that I had away from me.
And Purdue Pharma has pled guilty twice to federal crimes for false marketing. The Sacklers were never charged with crimes, and they've denied any wrongdoing. But a lot of public health experts believe this company's actions cleared the way for the opioid fentanyl crisis that killed more than 50,000 people last year alone.
Right, so Purdue Pharma is in bankruptcy now, and there's a new deal that states have signed off on. What's new in this deal?
Yeah, so the big change is this deal would no longer force people who believe they were harmed by OxyContin to drop civil lawsuits that are directed at members of the Sackler family. The last attempt at a deal that was overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court included broad legal protections for the Sacklers. That was really controversial. Under this deal, the Sacklers are expected to pay roughly $6.5 billion out of their personal fortunes. They'll give up ownership of the company, but they won't get that broad immunity from lawsuits. I reached out to the Sacklers for comment about this and haven't heard back. But legal experts I talked to say this version of the settlement is a lot more likely to survive legal challenges.
How will this money be spent if this deal is finalized?
Yeah, most of the money, including $1 billion coming from Purdue Pharma's company coffers, will go to states and communities over the next 15 years. Activists hope this money will be spent helping more people in addiction get better treatment and healthcare. One thing I'm hearing a lot of concern about, though, is that this money could wind up redirected just to prop up existing programs. That's because the Trump administration is now trying to make deep cuts in federal spending. Also, $850 million of this money is going to go to individual victims and families harmed by OxyContin. Ryan Hampton, the activist I spoke to, said he only expects to receive about $3,500.
And for $3,500 to be a paycheck to absolve Purdue's role in destroying my life is a meaningless gesture. But at this point, I'm ready to put this behind me.
So as we near the end of this legal battle over OxyContin, Hampton and others I've been talking to say they're left with really big questions here about whether this led to any kind of real justice.
Brian, you've been reporting on this a long time. Really quick, you mentioned the end of this legal battle, but does this story ever really truly have an end?
Well, right now we're still seeing tens of thousands of people die from opioid deaths every year, and so this public health crisis continues.
That's NPR addiction correspondent Brian Mann. Brian, thank you.
Thank you.